Hobbes theory and its use in physics. Now, since I only have 3 hours, and since Hobbes theory is actually quite a complicated subject, I'm going to try and give a very general overview of what Hobbes theory is, and try and focus on how it's used in physics, in particular quantum theory. I just start. And I'll try and give as many examples as possible in how Hobbes theory is used in quantum theory. Now, since it's a kind of technical subject, there are going to be a lot of definitions, theorems, and proofs, but what I decided to do is to leave those to some lecture notes which I've written, and I'll put up on my homepage. And in the course, I'll just try and give more kind of conceptual descriptions of stuff with examples, which I think is much better. If I just write definitions and theorems, it's pretty useless, really. You can read that on your own. Okay, so now the first thing is, why do we want to use Hobbes theory in physics, and particularly quantum theory? And the reason is to overcome certain conceptual problems which are present in quantum theory, and which you can boil down to how quantum theory is expressed mathematically. And basically, how quantum theory is expressed mathematically implies that you have a non-realist theory, and by this I mean that you cannot assign values to quantities a priori, but you have a repeated set of measurements, and you get probability of outcome. So it's an instrumentalist interpretation. And obviously, for its applicability, you need the notion of measurement, external observer, and observed system, all notions which are hard to define in the context of closed system, like quantum cosmology. And not only that, also in the context of quantum gravity, this notion seemed problematic. In fact, to my knowledge, all the approaches to quantum gravity really use quantum theory as it is. They don't change the math, they just use it as it is. So they also inherit the interpretation, which is an instrumentalist interpretation. And so in this theories of quantum gravity, for me, it's very hard to understand what, for example, the concept of a measurement of a space-time property is, if the notion of a measurement requires a fixed space-time background to perform the measurement. And also notions like probabilities of space-time properties seems a bit problematic. So the aim of Hobbes theory is to try and redescribe or reformulate quantum theory using a different type of maths, namely Hobbes theory, in such a way that it retains some realism. So in such a way that you do not fall into this interpretational problems. So the aim is really to redescribe quantum theory in a more realist way. Now, although you end up just simply rewriting quantum theory, that's not all that Hobbes approach is. In fact, it's part of a much bigger kind of approach, at the heart of which is a redefinition of what a theory of physics actually is. So in the Hobbes approach, at the very fundamental level, is an understanding of the conceptual framework and what a theory of physics actually is, and then apply this insight to quantum theory, and the hope is eventually to apply this insight to quantum gravity. So the first thing to understand is, what is a theory of physics in this Hobbes framework? This is the first time I give lectures, so anything I do wrong, just say. Especially my handwriting. Okay. Okay, now when you define a theory of physics, you normally try and talk about a system. I mean, that's the point of having a theory of physics. You talk about systems. It could be the entire universe, it could be a ball on a plane, whatever, but you talk about a system. So the first ingredient is a system. Then a theory of physics enables you eventually to reason about the system. So to this system, you associate an abstract language. Now this language will eventually enable you to talk about the system. So what do I mean by an abstract language? By abstract language, I mean the following. I mean a set of term types Now, what this term type, what the different types will be, I'll describe later. But for now, just think of them as like your atomic building blocks. So you can have variables, you can have sentences, just the atomic building blocks which you create your language with. Then you have logical connectives. These are and, or, not, if, then. And this enables you to create compound terms, so create more complex sentences. And then you have rules of inference, which then gives you logic. And this rules of inference, as the name tells you, enables you to deduce statements from already given one. So these are really the essential elements which make your language a well-defined deductive system of reasoning. So you can talk about things with this language, with these terms. Okay, so that's the first ingredient. The second is the theory type. So you have your system S. Now you want to know if you're talking about a quantum system. A classical. Or eventually a quantum gravity system. So you want to know what system you're talking about. And the reason is because the maths that you will use eventually to describe your theory will differ. So for classical theory, we know it's sets, the maths you use. Now for quantum theory, it is set so far, but I'm trying to argue that you should change the maths in order to have a more realist theory. So I'm not going to say what it is. I mean, it is a topos, but for now, I'll just call it topos I. So you have a type of maths. And for quantum gravity, maybe you'll have yet another topos. Okay? So far we have a system, you have a language which enables you to talk in a coherent way about your system, and you know what theory type you're considering, you know if it's a big system or a very small system, so you know the type of maths which eventually will be used to express your theory. Now, what a theory of physics is the following. So it's a representation of your abstract language in the appropriate mathematical framework. So that's what theory of physics is. So you have, so in this topos framework, you see that you really try and redefine what a theory of physics is and what the mathematical framework looks like. And only once you represent this abstract definition of your theory of physics in a mathematical framework, you obtain a real theory of physics. So at the very fundamental level in this approach, there's the logical structure. There is the language LS. So the logic is at the fundamental level. Now, in this recipe, which it is very abstract, but you still have certain degrees of freedom. And these degrees of freedom are which type of maths you use to eventually represent your theory, and what are the minimum set of these type of elements which make your language a language of a physical system. I mean, if we're doing poetry, then you would have very different types of these symbols. I mean, logical connectives, only those, but you would have very different types of term types and rules of inference. But we're doing physics, so the question is, what is the minimum amount of each of these types for this to be a well-defined language for a physics system. Now, as far as the logical connective goes, as I just said, you really just have these if you consider single time. You can consider time-dependent logical connectives. That has been done, but I'm not going to talk about it now. But if you consider single time, then these are really the only ones you have. So your freedom is in the term types and the rule of inference and what type of math you choose to represent this abstract language. Okay, so now what are the minimum amount of these types of elements to make your language a language of a physical system? In order to describe it, I'll give an example in classical physics. So this is the abstract language, and here we have classical physics. And as I said, this uses sets. Okay, so what are the term types? What are the ingredients? Now, the first, if you talk about a system, you might want to know all the possible states of a system. So you have a term of type sigma, which is your state space object. You might want that if you're talking about a system, right? Then another term that you might want is a term which gives you values of things. So this is a term of type R and is a quantity value term. Now, you should note that so far I'm not saying that this is the reals, I'm not saying this is a differential manifold, I'm just saying that they're term types which have a certain role. There's no maths here yet. The maths, I mean, you define them mathematically only once you project them in whatever mathematical universe you want to talk about. So far they're, I don't know, operationally defined or functionally defined. Then the other thing you want is quantities. You want to talk about quantities. So quantities are maps from your state object to your quantity value object. So there's a collection of maps. So map terms from your state object to the reals. Again, if you think of classical physics, that's precisely what they are.
So no, this is a quantity.
That's but the thing.
Oh, so okay, I'll do that.
It's the thing that you can put into the quantity to get something.
Yeah, I would say it's a, yeah. That's the second thing. The state is a term, but yeah, essentially you do that. But it's a term of type. So, by P sigma, by this I mean the collection of all subobjects. Of the state object. Okay, so a state is a subobject of your state object. So again, if you think of classical physics, your state is a point or a singleton. So it's a subobject of your state object. And yes, it is something that in order to define a value given a state, then use this map on the state. And that's what a value is. So the value of a physical quantity given a state is a term of type R. In classical physics, just a number. So we applied this map to a state, and you get a term of type R. That's a value of a quantity. Then another object that you need is a concept of a proposition. Now, so you have your state space, you have your quantities, you have your states, you know how to define values for the states, and you want to make propositions regarding values of states. So the most general proposition is of this form, and it tells you that the quantity A has a value in a certain range. And this is a term of type. So it's a sub-object of your state space. State object, sorry. So you can think of it as the sub-object or your state object for which this proposition is true. And another term is the rules of inference. Plus logic and logical connectives. Now these again are these guys. Now I won't go into the details of what the rules of inference are. Those are all explained in the lecture notes. It's going to be a bit too long. But the importance is that in this abstract language, you have a certain logic which makes you play around with your propositions. And the last term is the truth object, which enables you to decide whether the propositions that you make in this abstract language are true or false. Okay? So these are actually essentially the minimum amount of elements for your language to be a language about a physical system. So any proposition regarding physical properties of your system can be made once you have this set of terms. Again, at this level, they're just defined according to the role they have. They're not defined in any mathematical way. In order to define them mathematically, you project or you represent them in a special the maths that you choose, and for classical physics it sets. So we'll do that. Okay, I'm not sure there's enough space. Okay. So the first is your state object. Newtonian physics, you just have your state space, right? So you have some differential manifold. The quantity value object is just the reals. Your physical quantities are maps from your state space to the reals. That is actually what physical quantity is in classical physics. So for each physical quantity, there's a correspondence between that and a map from the state space to the reals. A state is a point. Or if you consider a singleton, it's a sub-object subset of your state space. The value of a physical quantity, you just apply this map to your state and you obtain a number. So it's a term of type R, it's a real number. So, well, S instead of singleton. So that's a number is a term of type R. Okay, then a proposition.
Physical quantities act on the state space of, they act on subsets, right, of the...
Yeah.
But when you wrote it, in the first line, right? When you wrote it, it's going from the state space object to R. I mean, it's like, is that like a function, is it, or not?
Yes, it is, yeah.
But it's
so
not.
So it's a fun. I mean, this is at the very abstract level. It's
but it's not acting on the power set?
Uh,
Yeah, okay, yeah, you should actually have some class. Yeah, you're right, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, it's just in classical physics, okay, you have points and that's why you just, okay. Yeah, thank you about that. Okay, then the other concept of a proposition. Now, we've seen that a proposition is a term of type P sigma. So, how is it in classical physics? Again, this is proposition, and this is identified with the sets in your state space for which the value of that quantity actually lies in the appropriate subset. So it is subset of your state space. You can also call it like this. Right? So your state space, you pick out all those sets for which, all those states for which this is true. So it is a term of type P sigma. Yeah. Then the internal logic and the maths. Now, since we're in sets, the internal logic is Boolean, which comes with its rules of inference, etc. The important thing is now that you have an internal logic, internal maths, the logical connective, which I just defined as symbols, which you define them operationally according to truth tables, but the abstract symbols, now that you have a maths, they actually become well-defined mathematical operations. By this I mean that the OR now becomes the union, the AND becomes the intersection, the negation, well, the not, becomes the complement, and the if, then, becomes the complement union set. So at the level of the language, these were just symbols that had a certain function. Now that you represent this language in a maths, these actually become well-defined mathematical operations. So they kind of acquire meaning, really. Okay, and the last element is the truth object. And since we're in Boolean algebra, the truth object is the two-element set that tells you if something is true or false. So in classical logic, you only have true or false. Now, how does this work? Oh, hi. I'll draw a picture to show you how the truth object actually works. Okay, so assume you have a proposition. And we've seen that's a subset, that's your state space, that's a subset of your state space for which the proposition is true. Then you have your truth object. What this truth object does, it tells you whether a proposition is true given a state. And it tells you whether it's false given a state. So this is the so-called characteristic function, really, that's what it is in sets, right? So this characteristic function works is you get a set, state, and it gives you value 1 if the value of that quantity for that state lies in the appropriate range, and value false otherwise. So that's why you call this a truth object. Now, it turns out that there is, as you can see also from this picture, there is a one-to-one correspondence between sub-objects of subsets, sub-objects, if you want to be general, of an object and maps between this object and the truth object. Now, in sets, you have points, right? Sets actually does have points. So you can identify these maps with this characteristic functions which acts on points. Now, in a general category, in a general topos, you do not have points, but this still holds. So what we've seen so far is how the abstract language was
of sigma omega.
Oh, homomorphic. Or maps. From
sigma. Maps.
Homomorphic maps.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Okay, so we've seen how this abstract language gets represented for classical physics in the mathematics of sets. Now, not in this lecture, but in the following, we'll see how the same abstract language will be represented for quantum theory in a different type of maths, which will not be set, but will be a general topos. And obviously, each of the elements will be different, but the main difference will reside in the fact that this will not be the real numbers. In fact, in a general topos, you don't really have real numbers. So our values won't be real numbers, be something else. And the truth object here will not be just true or false, but in a general topos, you will have many truth values, which means that you will not have a Boolean algebra, but you will have a multivalued logic. So these are the main differences, multivalued logic and a generalized algebra that comes with it. Okay, now before explaining how to represent this abstract language in a general topos, I need to explain what a topos is. And a topos is a very special type of category. So I don't know how many are familiar with category theory. I'll just assume you're not. And explain from the start what category is. Are you familiar with category? Is anyone familiar with category theory? But I think it's just better that I'll start from scratch, really. Okay, before giving the axiomatic definition of what a category is, it's important to understand what it means to work in category theory. So in sets, which is the math that we always use, one is used to define objects and relations in an internal way. So you define an object according to a common properties that the elements of that set have. So there's an internal description. In category theory, you don't have an internal description, but you have external way of defining objects. So you define your object according to relations which it has with other objects in the category. So there's an external, there's a relational way. It's like, I don't know if you're philosophy, but like set theory is Cartesian philosophy, category theory is more Leipzig, is relational. And so that's, in order to work with category, you have to perform a change in perspective. So to understand this, I'll give examples. Okay, I'll use sets to give examples, since sets is a category and is a special type of category because it allows for an internal and external descriptions of things. Okay, so what do I mean by internal, external? For example, the concept of an element. The internal way is just a belonging relation. A belongs to S. That's an element of S. Hmm?
just in terms of the property that A belongs to S internally. The external description is a map between a singleton, a set with only one element, and the set you're considering an element of. So in this case, A would be identified with the map F from the singleton to your set. Now, being a singleton, you can only have one domain, you can only pick one element. So you have a lot of maps, and each of them identify a unique element of S. So, for example, B would be identified with the function G. So you see here, an element is just a belonging. Here is a map between two elements in set. Subobject, subset. Okay, a subset, in the internal way of describing it, is simply you pick out all those elements which have the common property that they belong both to A and to S. Right, so if X belongs to A, then X belongs to S. There's an internal, according to, you pick out which elements belong to both. The external way of defining it is pretty much what we did there. So it's a map from your set to the truth object. Right? So I'll just draw it again. So this is your subset A. That's the truth object. And this map picks out your subset A. So in sets, it's precisely that. It would be the characteristic function. But in a general category, again, this holds. But in a general category, you don't necessarily have points. Then another, so these are elements, so to say, objects. But you can also define internally and externally operations and properties of operations. So, for example, associativity. Internally, you just say that this element follow this property. Oops, that's right. For okay, B and C and S. This is an internal way of defining associativity. Now, externally, first of all, you have to define an external way of defining multiplication, and that again is a map from the cross product, which is still a set, two sets. And what this map does, it just picks any two elements and it multiplies them. So this is how you define product. Now, associativity, instead, is identified by the condition that the diagram I'm going to draw commutes. So first I'll draw it, then I'll explain it. If you notice in category theory, you just do everything with arrows. What you do with it. Okay, so this associativity condition is equivalent to the fact that this diagram commutes. By commuting, I mean if you go this way or if you go that way, you get the same thing. So the maps here are the follow. So this is the identity. It just means it maps S to itself. So any element of S gets mapped to itself. This is our product map. This is the product map. This is the product map. And this is the product map and the identity. So I'm claiming that the commutativity of this is equivalent to that. So you try it. You get A, B, C. You apply the map, the identity map to A, and you get A. You apply the multiplication map to B and C, and you get B dot C. You apply the multiplication map to these two guys now, and you get A dot B dot C. You go this other way. You first apply the multiplication to these two, A dot B, and then the identity,
then you multiply this two. A dot C. And they have to be the same because this diagram commutes. So instead of defining commutativity in terms of individual elements, you just say that this diagram commutes. Now it's interesting to see how you can also write all the axioms of group theory in an external way. I described them all in the lecture notes. This is one of them, the associativity, but you can describe all of them. And I'll just do one, and the others are in the lecture notes. And the one I'll do is identity. So the internal way of describing the existence of identity is as follows. For all elements, this holds. Now we want an external way to define that. So first of all, you need to define what the identity is, identity map. And this is the constant map to each G you associate the identity. That's the external definition of what an identity element is in a group. Then this condition here is the fact that is equivalent to the fact that this diagram commutes. Okay, so this is equivalent to the fact that going this way, you get the same result. I'll do it. So you get a G. Oh, sorry, I didn't write what these are. So if you go that way, or that way, is the same. So you get an element G, you apply the constant map, which gives you the identity element. No, sorry, I'm going to say, sorry. That makes more sense. Okay. You apply the constant map, that you get identity. Then you apply the identity map, you get G. And you multiply them, you get G dot G. Then you go this way. You first apply the identity map, so the element stays unchanged. Then you apply the constant map, you get E. Then you multiply them, and you get G dot E. You go this way, which is the identity, so you get G. GG. You can apply the product of two maps to the same set. You can do that. You can.
If you have G and then you do one thing and then the next thing you should just get one element. If you do two things, you should go from G plus G. No.
To this G, you apply two of them to the same G. Okay, I mean, you could do it like this, G cross G, and then, okay, that's maybe a little more correct. Yeah.
This would be this thing that to each G, you get the same. I just didn't want to, okay. Okay, so I don't know if I managed to convey the idea of why
category theory is important. It's not just because it's kind of elegant, but it's also because it's managed to abstract the universal properties of certain mathematical operations of objects which do not depend on the particularity of whatever objects you're considering. So it's like a bit the difference if you do a calculation with a specific reference frame, a specific set of coordinates, or at the very abstract level. Category theory is doing it at the very abstract level. Okay, now I'll say what a category is, if I haven't said that. And now I actually have to give a definition, an axiomatic definition, but it's very easy. What a category is. Definition. The category consists of objects. So what these objects are will depend on what your category is, but you do have objects, and the collection of them is just denoted like this. And then you have relations between these objects, which are called morphisms. So for any two objects, you have a set of maps or relations between these two objects. Now, obviously, again, according to what category you're considering, this set could be empty. You could have one, or you could have many. But the main thing is that you have objects and relations. These relations undergo certain properties that you kind of saw already here. One is composition. So if you have two maps such that the the codomain of one is equal to the domain of the other, then you can compose them to get a map from A to C. Now, I write composition this way, which the reason being, if you think of diagrams, you have this, really. So that if you have an object here, then you apply F, then you apply G, you get this. That's why the order is in this way. A lot of books do it the other way around, but I think of a community diagram, so I prefer this order. But anyway, just you can compose them. And composition is associative, which is what we saw before. If you have another map, then you can compose these guys. Well, it's pretty much what I said before, but I'll just, for sake of completeness, I'll just write it again. And you get associativity. And then another important property is that for each object in the category, you have an identity map. So a map which ends and starts in A. So that's the axiomatic definition of what a category is. It's a bunch of elements with certain relations between them such that these properties are satisfied. Now, there are actually a lot of categories that we work with in physics. It's just that I don't think they've ever been considered as such. I mean, I don't know if they've ever been thought of as categories. Like, for example, the category of vector spaces over some field, that is a category. So it's got objects, vector spaces, and maps, morphisms, linear transformations. or the category of topological spaces. Objects are topological spaces. And morphisms are continuous maps. The collection of all groups of the category. Actually, I think it's just called like that. And has got groups as objects and group homeomorphisms. Group homeomorphisms. So it's just to show, I mean, there are many more in the lecture notes, there are much more detailed examples. It's just to show that we work with lots of categories in physics that just never thought of as categories. Okay, so I explained briefly what the category is and what it means to work with categories, and that there are actually a lot of categories in physics. Now, this is all good and well. However, it would be quite useless if all these categories didn't talk to each other. That's just a bunch of categories. But you can make them talk to each other. So you can define maps between categories. And these are called functors. And they have two types. So you have maps between categories. And these are called functors. And there are two types of that. One is covariant. And one is contravariant. Okay, so what are these maps? So imagine you have two categories. You want to define a covariant map between them. So what this covariant functor, covariant functor does, to each element, it assigns an element in your other category. And since category have morphism, this functor has to be such that the morphisms are respected. So to each morphism or map, it assigns a morphism in this category in such a way that the order of the relation is preserved. So if you had a picture, and you apply the F functor, a covariant functor, then you get a mirror image, really, of this graph here. So what a covariant functor does, it maps the objects and the internal structure of this category to the objects and internal structure of this category in a way that it mirrors the direction of the relations. Yeah.
And graphical way, it's like a picture, it's like a certain type of graph?
Yeah.
Is that a way to look at it?
Yeah. So, like this. Well, this could be a three-element category. So it would be objects and maps. These are the morphisms.
So when you talk about, like, mapping between categories, you can talk about, like, mapping between graphs?
Yes.
Like, just to...
No, this is just, yeah.
Like, to picture visually.
So you map this graph to a similar graph in the other category. For example, this as a category. This is another category. It's just that the vertices would represent the objects and the maps would represent the morphisms, the segments.
The number of lines, just like there's
No, no, there's it depends on your category. So if you have, for example, if this represents inclusion, then obviously you have only one for each two objects. So you can't have many. But if it represents something else, then you could have many. It depends. The rules of this,
of the arrows, depends on what category you have and the relations. Okay, so an example of a covariant functor, a very easy one, is the power set functor. So to each set, it maps the power set, and to each morphism, it maps a respective morphism between the power sets in such a way that the order is preserved. So how this works is as follows. I mean, the power set, again, is a collection of all subsets. Right? So the image of this map is a map between the collection of all subsets of X and the collection of all subsets of Y, so that if you get a subset here, then you obtain the following. I keep forgetting you can move this thing. Which is a subset of Y. So you use this. Now, this is a covariant functor. Now, last thing I'm going to say is a contravariant functor. And this is defined as follows. So again, you have two categories. Now, a contravariant functor, I forgot to say one thing, though, sorry. That's important, that the order of compositions here is preserved, like you can see from, in a covariant functor, actually, you can just see it from here. If you compose this two, then a contravariant functor you compose in the same direction. And if you have an arrow here, the identity, then the image of the identity is the identity on the image. It just really maps the same types of graphs. Yeah, a contravariant function says a little bit more complicated. It maps objects to objects, but it maps relations. It does map them two relations in here, but the mirror image of them. So it shifts the order of the relations. So if this was a contravariant functor, you had to change the direction of the arrows. You would be going the other way around. So if you have a relation between these two, a contravariant functor maps it to a relation in another category, but that goes the other way. So what this means is that composition is preserved, but the other way around. Right? So the image of the composition is still a composition, but you reverse the order. As far as the identity element, nothing happened. So the image of the identity is still the identity of the image. Now the analog of that example for a contravariant functor, is as follows. So you have a contravariant version of the power set functor, and this is as follows. We'll call it squiggle. This again is a functor from set to set. So each set you get subset, power set, and to each map you obtain a map which goes the opposite direction. And
and is defined as follows. You get a set, a subset, and then you map to it this subset, which is defined in terms of the pullback of the original map. So for each relation, you have a relation going the opposite way, which is defined like this. Now, the reason I went through all this lengthy functors and contrarian functors is because, well, apart from the fact they're important because you can compare categories and you can make them talk to each other, but most important of all is the fact that if you have a contravariant, it could be either covariant or contravariant functor from two categories, the collection of all possible covariant or contravariant is actually a category in itself. And you call it like this. And not only that, it's actually a topos. And in the case in which this is sets, then you have this category here, which is the collection of all covariant or contravariant functors from this category to sets. And this, for a particular choice of this category, will be the topos that we'll use. Okay, now I'm going ahead, but the importance is that the collection of all contravariant on one side, or covariant functors from two categories, is itself a category and is a topos. But I'll stop here now. It's a type of topos. I mean, there's lots of topos, but yes.
Oh, it's an example of topos.
Yeah. I mean, there's tons of topos. This is just one. And this is the one that we're going to use. Bit for now. In the next lecture, I'll talk about that.
Any questions? Are these the only types of functors?
Excuse me?
Do you have other types of functors other than covariant and contravariant?
Yeah.
Mixtures?
No. Just this. You cannot either have one.